Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful, beautiful Wednesday. I'm very happy to be here with you. I'm Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Majora Carter from the Majora Carter Group. And I'll tell you more about the work that she's doing. I'm really excited to have her here with me today. And I want to share with you what's been going on in the garden. The garden is blossoming. It's really, you know, this time of year is always great. I harvested all my garlic this past week and sat down with some of my interns and braided all the garlic, and that was fun. Now we're hanging it up and we'll let it dry a little bit. It's amazing. One doesn't think of garlic as juicy, but if you take garlic right out of the garden and squeeze it, it's quite juicy. So you can have some garlic juice that way. But anyway, so we braided all the garlic. We built a little trestle for all the cucumber plants, a trellis, and the cucumber plants are growing and are very happy with their new little trellis. And the bok choy we've harvested, and we're planting another round of bok choy. We just put in some more arugula and some more lettuce. Our lettuce is doing great. We've been eating salad every day. And Mizuna greens up the wazoo. Mizuna greens are baby mustard greens, and they're probably one of my favorite greens, and they're very hard to find organic during the year. So they're a real treat, and I can't seem to get enough of them. So I have enough for everybody. So if you're in the area of Old Westbury, stop by, have some Mizuna greens on the house. I'll have so many cucumbers, too. I'm going to have to start pickling and probably do a class on canning so that we can all, get up with our skills. And I'll have so many tomatoes also when they all start coming in. So we'll do some canning together. I have arranged four cooking classes in August that I'd like to share with all of you. And the first one is a vegan cooking class. And they're all on Thursdays on the IE Green Homestead. We will harvest the vegetables from the garden, and then we will cook together from 6 to 9. And so the first class is a vegan cooking class. The second class is a raw cooking class, and I have a guest chef, Okima, from the Live Island Cafe joining me to cook with that, because I'm relatively new in raw foods, but I'm really enjoying experimenting with it. But she's a pro, so she'll join us for that cooking class. The third cooking class is a vegetarian cooking class, which means it will incorporate some dairy products as well. And the last class is going to be a seafood fish class. And I have some local fish being given to us, well, not given to us, but I have a source for local fish from a local fisherman out on the island through Brett Trolley, who was my guest last week from Sustainable NAMA, the Northeast Marine Association. Anyway, I forget. But he's wonderful, and he's arranged for some local fish for our cooking class. And that's it. And I hope some of you can join us for that. It's really going to be a lot of fun. And I've been working with a couple interns. I actually have three interns now. One is from the Netherlands. One is from Long Island, and actually two are from Long Island, but one just got back from New Zealand. So they're all working with me in the garden, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate having help. It's a lot of work. And when you have a garden, a large garden, you really get a sense and appreciation for the work that it takes to grow your own food. It's really unbelievably long. I won't say tedious, because it's lovely work, but it's long, hot work in this weather. And so it's just so wonderful, though. There's nothing quite like growing your own vegetables. And, you know, where a vegetable, if it has, you know, little brown spots and you buy in the market, you'll avoid it. But if you grew it, you just cut that part away, you still will eat it because you grew it. And it's a whole new thing. So the recipe that I want to share with you this week, as I said, I've been really experimenting with a lot of raw desserts, because one of my clients is trying to eat 80% raw now. So I've been doing a lot more raw cooking. And this recipe, and one thing I've found is the raw desserts are so easy. It takes a little time, because if you want to make a layer cake, you need to freeze in between each layer. So you need a little time, but they're quite easy. So this is a raw chocolate, raspberry, and pineapple layer cake. And for the crust, I did this in a food processor. I combined 1 cup of pecans, 3/4 cup of raw cacao powder, 6 dates, 1/4 cup of raw agave, 1/4 cup of coconut oil, and 1/4 cup of unsweetened shredded coconut, and just a pinch of salt. And I pulse that in the food processor till it all starts to stick together. And then I press that down into a cheesecake pan, a springform pan. And I was able to cover the whole bottom and come up the sides about 3/4 of the way up the sides. And then for the fillings, I'm doing four separate fillings. One is a chocolate ganache, which is just a very rich chocolate. And then I take half of that chocolate ganache and I mix it with a cashew cream that I make. And then one layer is pineapple puree and one layer is raspberry puree. So this is what you need for the fillings. For the chocolate ganache, you want 2 cups of the raw cacao powder, 2 cups of maple syrup, 3/4 cup of coconut oil, and 1 teaspoon vanilla. And you puree that in the food processor and then take it out of the food processor. Pour half of it into the bottom layer of the chocolate crust and put that into the freezer. And the other half just reserve for the cashew cream. So just reserve that on the side. Then in the food processor, you're going to puree the raspberry filling, which is 3 pints or 3 half pints of raspberries and 2 tablespoons of agave, and put that onto the side. And then for the pineapple filling, you're just going to puree 1 pineapple. You don't need any sweetener because the pineapple, hopefully you get a ripe one, is so sweet by itself. And you puree that, and then I put all the pureed pineapple into a sieve and let it drain. And the pineapple juice, you know, can be creative with and, you know, make a nice cocktail that evening or just drink it straight, whatever you'd like. But the pineapple juice you're going to keep separate. That's not in the dessert. But then you have the puree from the pineapple that's really, mostly the pulp, and it's really great. And so you're just going to freeze in between each layer, and depending on your freezer, depends on how long you have to wait in between each layer. So on top of the chocolate ganache, I put a layer of raspberry. Then I froze that. Then on top of the raspberries, I put the cashew cream, which you make by pureeing the cashews that you have soaked for a couple hours in the food processor, and adding the remainder, or actually half of the ganache to that, so that it becomes like a chocolate mousse. It's not as rich as the ganache by itself, but it's still it looks even like a chocolate mousse with the creamy cashews. And you put a layer of that on, and then freeze that, and then a layer of the pineapple, freeze that, and then I finish it with the top layer of the ganache so that it's a dark chocolate covering. And it's just enough to cover it, and then garnish the edges with raspberries. And it's so delicious and really beautiful. And I hope you all give it a try. It's just amazing how easy it is. And I'm showing Majora a picture right now.
Wow. Oh, my God.
But anyway, so when you cut into it, you can imagine you have all these different colors. You have, you know, the dark chocolate, and then you have the raspberry, and then you have a lighter chocolate, then you have the pineapple, and then you have the dark chocolate again. And it's really beautiful. So, and, you know, it's relatively speaking, as desserts go, it's pretty good for you. So give it a try. So anyway, that's my recipe. Now I'd like to invite my guest on, who I'm so happy to have here with us, Majora Carter. She's a real mover and a shaker in her world. She is probably the only person to receive an award from the John Podesta Center for American Progress and a Liberty Medal for Lifetime Achievement from the Rupert Murdoch New York Post. Fast Company magazine named her one of the 100 most creative people in business, and the New York Times described her as the green power broker. Majora hosts the Peabody Award. She got her an award for a public radio series called The Promised Land, and she serves on the board of U.S. Green Building Council and the Wilderness Society. And as a matter of fact, after our little interview here, she's scooting down to D.C. for the Wilderness Society. She has a long list of awards and honorary degrees, including a MacArthur Genius Fellowship. And she founded and led Sustainable South Bronx from 2001 to 2008, way before most people were even talking about sustainability, and even fewer in places like the South Bronx. By 2003, Majora coined the term Green the Ghetto as she pioneered one of the nation's first urban green-collar job training and placement systems and spearheaded legislation that fueled demand for those jobs. Majora's 2006 TED Talk was one of six presentations to launch that groundbreaking website. Since 2008, her consulting company has exported climate adaption, urban micro-agribusiness, and leadership development strategies for business, government, foundations, universities, and economically underperforming communities. So that's quite a handful of work you're doing. And I'm really so happy that you're here in the studio with us.
Thank you.
To talk about the work that you're doing.
All I really want to talk about is that chocolate pineapple raspberry cake that you just described. Oh, my gosh.
It's really so good. It's amazing, you know, that these raw desserts. I mean, I've been doing one after the next, and pretty much every week now for a few months, and it's been really fun.
Wow. I'm not a big fan of cooking, so that kind of sounds like my speed, like mixing things together and waiting for them to freeze. Like, I can handle that.
Right, right. And that was good. And then, of course, you know, it would happen that the freezer then breaks,
you know.
Like in the morning, you know, after all the layers are done, I come down and it's not frozen anymore. There's still layers, you know, but I refroze it, but it's just like, oh, you've got to be kidding. Of all days, you know, it's 90 degrees outside and the freezer decides to crap out on me. So anyway, you spearheaded a national so-called green jobs movement. How did you do that? And what do you think of the results? What's going on with that?
It became clear when I started working it's my hometown, the South Bronx in New York City. And so I grew up when it was, you know, the infamous burning Bronx and, you know, kind of lived through that and then also lived through the attendant economic disinvestment, you know, of the neighborhood. And so we're one of the poorest congressional districts in the country, in addition to being one of the most environmentally challenged. And so I felt that some of my work really needed to focus on how do you bridge the gap between the environment and the economy. And so we worked specifically first on creating new projects that just improve the quality of life there. So we transformed dumps into parks. You know, I spearheaded a Greenway initiative within our local community, but it became really clear that what we were missing was the people in the local community actually having both a personal as well as a financial stake in improving the environment. And so we had a tremendous opportunity to figure out a way to create a job training program that would literally place people from our community, many of whom were generationally impoverished or who were actually cycling in and out of the criminal justice system, and teaching them the skills of ecological restoration. And to start, it was wetland restoration, because most of the work that we were doing was along the Bronx River in New York City, in the Bronx, right? Which was literally six blocks away from the house I grew up in and didn't know it was there. And so that was where people first got their training, and then it moved into things like urban forestry management and later green roof installation, and even learning how to clean up contaminated lands for a more a better reuse. And you know, much of that work was about green infrastructure, which is sort of a natural way to manage stormwater and help reduce urban heat island impact, which is basically this phenomena where, you know, vegetated surfaces and areas or surrounding cities are actually much cooler simply because of the vegetation that's there. So we focused on projects like that as a way to help our cities adapt to what we know is the way that the climate's changing, regardless of whether you think man did it or, you know, whatever. The point is we're dealing with some crazy issues around weather right now. And so we figured that this was a way to help train people to do this work that was so necessary and needed to be done, and actually also help support them move into the world of work and create jobs with dignity for them.
I'd like to back up just a little bit. Having grown up in the South Bronx, how did you get involved in or develop the desire to want to make that change? Because I'm sure there's so many people around you that were not thinking like that.
I have to tell you, when either I and most people, you know, growing up in the South Bronx, you know, back during the time when I did, which was in the 70s and then the 80s, very few of us were thinking about the environment, you know, per se. It was the environment to us was how do you, you know, in a place that we know had been largely either ignored at best, you know, by policymakers and electeds and all sorts of other folks, to either sometimes actively worked against, you know, whether that in terms of how the highways were built through our community, you know, the way that there were lots of waste facilities and other types of negative projects that came in, even frankly the insertion of a particular kind of heroin, you know, into our communities. You know, weren't looking, you know, at the environment as anything except how do we make our neighborhood a better place. And for most of us, and including me, it was like, how do I get the hell out of here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so starting from the time I was about 7, maybe 8 years old, my brother was killed when I was 7, and, you know, as a result of a drug war. And, you know, that's when the neighborhood started to burn around me. And I was a smart kid, and I knew it, and I was like, you know what, my days here are numbered, and I'm going to see to it, because I'm a smart kid. I know I'm going to go to college, and
really?
My plan mm-hmm. was to go to get myself into the Bronx High School of Science, and which I did, and then get myself into what I called a name school, which mm-hmm. was like, whether it was an Ivy League or a Little Three, you know, I knew I was going to go to one of those schools, because I figured that was my way out of this place.
Wow, smart little girl. Good.
It was, you know, I don't know how smart it was, but there was a sense of desperation that I think many of us dealt with. And I think as I got older and realized that the way many poor communities of all different colors are actually planned, you know, that kind of feeling is actually bred into us. You know, so if we do, you know, have the capacity to become successful, of course we leave. You know, many of us aren't taught that we don't have to move out of our neighborhood in order to live in a better one. And, you know, as I got older and realized that there were very deliberate decisions that created communities like mine, I realized that I could either take that information and pretend I didn't see it and move on, you know, with my life, or I could make my life a part of making my community a better place to be for mm-hmm. myself and for mm-hmm. others. And I chose the second path.
Right. Interesting, because I grew up on Long Island, completely the opposite, where there was affluence all around me, and I grew up so, like, anti-money. Like, I was so turned off to the materialistic world around me that I just felt was so shallow and so horrible. I also couldn't wait to get out of there, but it was for a different reason. And when I found myself back there, it was also interesting because in a different way, I was looking at it saying, you know, yes, there's lots of places I go where there's people that care about the environment and care about people and care about the earth, and they don't right here. They think global warming is just going to sail right over their big houses and, you know, not touch them at all. And and I realized that the work that I want to do is really needed there. That, you know, I mean, I was doing a cooking class one time, and, you know, and there was a bunch of women there that, you know, were affluent, and they just looked at me and they said, "It's so good for us to know someone like you." Like I was a novelty, you know. And it's really, you know, I feel like being in the area where I am, I'm raising a consciousness also of people that don't want to do anything. They have the means that they could, but they just are not conscious about the problems, and they don't want to focus on them, and they just ignore them, and it doesn't affect them, and so they don't participate. And, you know, and because I'm in their face, you know, it's making a change.
Right.
So.
And sometimes they don't even see it. Like, one of the things that I realized when we first started, when I first started working on this work, is that people are so disconnected, you know, from, well, people even call it, it's like the environment, as if we're not a part of it. It's
right.
Like the economy, as if we're not a part of that either. And it's so interesting. And so, you know, so we throw something away. People have no idea what happens. You flush the toilet. People have no clue.
Right.
And you realize really early on, you know, that, I mean, you may call a modern convenience or whatever you want, but it's actually a disconnection with the way that our world actually functions, and we function within it. And so when people like you and I, you know, kind of show up and to illuminate the subject in a way that doesn't, you know, put them off, but just makes them go, you know, I never thought of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Then the burden is on them to realize, like, okay, I've got this information. What can I do about it?
Mm-hmm.
Or pretend that they don't see it. But it's your job my job, you know, has been done by just opening it up, the issue up to folks, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, one thing that I've been doing and for over 20 years is I work with a food pantry in Queens, and I've gotten people in my area, in this socioeconomic reality of the affluence that I live in, to volunteer to come out and work for these food pantries and literally out on the street, you know, usually it's around the holiday time, whatever, but making, you know, just so that they get a taste and see what is out there and hopefully take it then to the next step. And I have gotten other people to get more involved in that way. But what I love about what you, the work you're doing is you're really making change. Like, I know I'm just putting a Band-Aid on for the day and making the people feel better, but I've been doing it for 20 years, and it's the same people online, you know, and I've watched their children grow up online, and I know that's not the answer. You know, I know I'm, you know, it feels good that day, and I know I'm doing a nice thing, and I, you know, collect money, and I collect clothes, and I, you know, do a whole huge effort, but I know I'm not dealing with the root of the problem. Yeah. And that's what I love about the work that you're doing, is you're really looking at the root of the problem.
And we are, and thank you for that, but don't knock the work that you do.
I know.
Please.
It gives, you know, it gives people, a, you know, especially in my area, a taste of what it feels like to be out there, and they feel so good when they have that day that I want them to feel good and want to do it more.
Right.
But and if we all do it more, we can make some.
And you're right. If we, my work really is about creating real change on the ground. Like, I was, you know, early on when I started this work, it was all about, you know, we live in this incredibly environmentally challenged, economically challenged community. You know, and we, and I remember when the presidents would come to our community on the campaign trail, and of course, there'd be all sorts of promises and nothing would change. And so somehow or another, you know, and I was a kid when this would happen. And, you know, it kind of hit me that, you know, we are promised a lot of stuff, you know, all the time. And, you know, nothing ever changes. And so I thought, you know what, if I'm going to get in this game, I at the very least, I know that the, what I want to do is actually do some project-based development. So it was, it wasn't so much the advocacy work. And again, that's why we worked on doing things like literally taking a dump and transforming it into a park, you know, taking, you know, what was really just a big old street and put it, helping to put a greenway on it and making sure that that happened. Even helping people see the value in their own lives, you know, through, actually learning a skill around ecological restoration. So the changes could be, you know, as simple, you know, as literally looking in the mirror and knowing that you're a part of something changing. And, you know, and it became, you know, so over the past few years, I've been working as a consultant doing advisory services and speaking engagements around sustainable development. And it's been a really interesting road because one of the things that struck me no matter where I traveled around the country and even around the world, but specifically in this country, was that in terms of real estate development, there's only two kinds. And there's the kind, in poor communities rather, real estate development in poor communities, there's the kind that just simply promotes gentrification. Excuse me. So the place gets better and then the poor people are eventually just pushed out. Or the other kind is that the poor community is basically destined to stay poor. And you see that, you know, through the type of economic developments that are there, you know, everything, like you'll find plenty of fast food stores, plenty of liquor stores, lots and lots of highly subsidized, you know, rental housing, very little home ownership rates, you know, within those communities. And, but I think most importantly, a lack of hope from the people that, that live in those communities. And they sort of stay kind of stuck in a little box because they don't necessarily see that there's other types of things, you know, within their daily world. Like I have to say, even in my own neighborhood, and lots of people know me there, there are plenty of folks that automatically assume that I don't live in my own neighborhood because I'm what's considered successful. And successful people don't stay in communities like mine. So what I'm really interested in doing is actually using real estate development as a platform for social, environmental, and economic transformation and change in our communities by creating opportunities for aspirational communities, like literally intentionally aspirational communities that at its core are designed so that poor people can become less poor, so that you can have a mix of incomes living within the same community, so that there's actually a sense of aspiration and growth, and also a sense so that people of higher incomes can actually see people who aren't and thus you become, I think it desensitizes you to like your own, to what you consider to be just your own little life, and you realize there's other people out there, and also create new opportunities for economic development. It's like right now I'm really fascinated by the kinds of trends in both entrepreneurship as well as technology, and you know, why aren't we thinking about how do we create new opportunities for manufacturing in the 21st century, you know, within, you know, post-industrial American cities? You know, why can't we figure out ways to make those things happen in areas and replicate this model all over the country?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where I'm focusing a huge amount of my attention on right now. How do you create mixed income housing communities as well as mixed use commercial development that includes things like retail and manufacturing, you know, and other commercial developments?
Mm-hmm. But one of the things that you touched on that I think is so true, when you try with the, you know, building up a community, then you outprice so many of the poor people that are living there. I mean, I've seen it, you know, in the art world. Mm-hmm. I went to art school, and, you know, it's like, we'll go in, you know, artists will go in and make Greenwich Village great, and then they can't afford it. Go in and make Soho great, then they can't afford it. Then go in and make the East Village great, and then they can't afford it. You know, and so, you know, and now, so, what are they calling the South Bronx?
Some people call it SoBro, yeah.
Right? Pretty soon, SoBro will be like Soho, and, you know.
Well, yeah, and what I'd like to do is use a bunch of those other examples as cautionary tales and really think about how do you harness the power of gentrification? Because, you know, there's, poor people like living in better neighborhoods too. You know, we like to be, it would be really nice to have a decent place in my neighborhood to buy good produce. It'd be really nice to have a place to go and sit down and have a nice cup of coffee. It'd be really nice to have a whole bunch of things that I have to travel into Manhattan in order to find. You know, there are no bike shops. You know, there aren't any of the kind of places that I or even most of the people in my own neighborhood hang out in. Frankly, we go elsewhere. So it's like we're taking our dollars and putting it someplace else as opposed to circulating them throughout the local economy.
Right.
And so that really, that's the root of all this. It's like, why are we spending our money someplace else when it could be here supporting local economic developments right here in our own neighborhood?
Mm-hmm.
So that being said, oh my goodness, I just had a little brain freeze. So the point around so much of this is all about how do you create new opportunities, you know, in your local area so that these things can happen. Oh, so the cautionary tale. So again, harnessing the power of gentrification is something that we're interested in doing because we want the nice things associated with it. I think where we're going to be a little different is we're not trying to run away from the fact that things are going to change, you know, in our community. But we want to do something that we're calling community transition management. We want the people, you know, as our community is starting to get better, we are really interested in making sure the people that were a part of that change are prepared to participate in it. So if it means that, you know, you're watching as the value of your property, you know, right now they're going down, but, you know, and someone could say come in pretty soon and go, we're going to buy your house for a little bit more than it's worth right now. We want them to start thinking about, you know, no, it's not just about what's happening at this minute. In the long term, if you stay here, are you going to be able to benefit financially from actually owning a little piece of this community? And why wouldn't you, since the house belonged to your mom or your dad? And, you know, this could be something that has some equity that you could keep. You know, why aren't we thinking about ways to really nurture the developments of new economic developments in our own community and make sure that we're training people for that work? That's why, again, our focus on both technology as well as entrepreneurship and really bringing in those types of projects and nurturing that right now, you know, with the kind of programs that we're working on to get people prepared for that. So I'm not afraid of gentrification. I want a little bit of it because I think people will be happier, you know, mm-hmm. if they feel safe and comfortable, happy and able to provide the kinds of communities they want, you know, within their own neighborhood. So I want to be able to manage it. And that's what we're attempting to do right now, you know, as we develop this kind of this process for managing that transition. You know, I'm not saying I have all the answers, but all I know is that I've seen way too many people run away from it as if it's something bad. And I don't think there's anything romantic about poverty. nothing. The only people who can who will say that are people who have never been poor, and I've been poor. And you know what? It is not fun. And I don't want anybody else to have to go through it unnecessarily so. And I want to use everything that I have to in order to create new ways so that we can move people out of poverty and not just create more of a status quo as if it's an okay thing to be. It's not. I'm tired of the same people being poor year after year after year. It's like, why are we looking at the same people 20 years later on the same line? It's about making systemic change.
Right. And that's, you know, something that is so blatant to me.
Yeah.
I go there and I see the same people year after year. And I'm
not
just
setting
like,
up new opportunities for them.
And there's sweet people. There's no reason that they should be on this line. You know, I remember one time, this was many years ago, I, you know, always would bring my kids with me, and one was like, they can't really be poor. They have a cell phone, you know? You know, that was, you know, one of their early observations. And I was like, don't judge. If they're willing to wait 2 hours on this line for their meal.
Exactly.
You know, that might be their only link to being connected to
people.
Totally. Yep. And don't judge about that, you know? And but I'd love to feel like I was working towards some real change.
And you are.
Yeah.
You know, you are. But then there's also, you know, because, yes, I know that, you know, the Bible says there will always be the poor among us. But it never says that they have to be the same poor. Doesn't say that.
Right.
So I'm like, let's just not assume that there's not mobility. I mean, I think if you look back, you know, the pre-civil rights legislation around integration, you know, in the black communities, they were absolutely racially segregated. They were also economically diverse. And what you saw there was a sense of mobility and aspiration that was lost post integration.
Interesting. Uh-huh.
And so you had this unintended consequence of integration, which was that those that actually had what was, you know, perceived to be more hope and hopefulness, you know, those that actually were a bit more economically stable, when they had the ability to leave, they did. And what did it leave? It left these pockets of hopelessness that, guess what, are still existing to this day. To this day. And, you know, we're spending an enormous amount of money, you know, philanthropically, you know, on problems, you know, whether it's unemployment and poverty and whatever. And, you know, they've all gotten worse.
Yeah.
They've all gotten worse. So let's figure out different ways of managing it. So that's why I'm, you know, going full force into real estate development and really looking at it as a systemic way of transforming a community. Because I feel like even some of my work was Band-Aids. I mean, yeah, it was 50-some million dollars worth of it. But, you know, bottom line is, you know, since we didn't have a mechanism for making sure that some of those dollars were actually captured in the local economy, it didn't stay there.
Right, right.
So this is what we're working on doing.
Great. Well, I want to hear about the projects you're actually working on, but we're going to take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, we'll get into some of those projects. Hi, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm here in the studio with Majora Carter, who is an activist and environmental justice person who's really trying to make some change in the South Bronx area, and she's doing a great job. And I want to talk some more with her with some of the projects that she's actually working on in real estate development and trying to create the change that she would like to see her neighborhood become. So, Majora, when we took a break before, you were just about to get into what one of your latest projects is. Can you share that with us?
Well, last year, you know, when I became very interested in how you can use real estate development as a tool for community transformation and was just becoming more and more dismayed at the way real estate development was happening, you know, not just in the South Bronx, but nationally, where I've been working actually much more than in New York City over the past few years. And I was literally walking to my office one day, which is right around right up the street from my house. And, you know, I did the same thing that I did, you know, for almost more than 40 years at this point, which was look down the hill and see this huge white building, which was the former Spofford Juvenile Detention Facility. And it was one, and it's been there since the 1950s, and it was one of the country's most notorious juvenile detention facilities. You know, kids that went in there just came out more broken than when they were there. That's juvenile justice in our country, basically.
Right,
but that's
right.
another story. But my dad
criminal
was a,
justice,
yeah,
too, right?
In general, yeah.
Right.
But my dad was a janitor at this space, you know, back in the 60s and the 70s, and I remember him talking about how, to my mom, about how he wished that our house was bigger and that he could actually take in more kids and help raise them just to get them out of that situation. And so it was its presence in my life. And then I started thinking about that site itself could be a really tremendous way to sort of to show this theory of mine that what our communities actually need, you know, these kind of post-industrial communities that used to be dependent on manufacturing and had a lot of it, that these communities literally could transform themselves, you know, if there was a very intentional effort to create mixed income housing and mixed use commercial development on these sites. And lo and behold, you know, I looked at that site as a way to do that. And, you know, the city just, talked last month about that Spofford is actually going to be, you know, released next year, you know, and up for redevelopment in some kind of way.
So it's not a juvenile detention center
anymore.
It
was
closed.
Yeah, it was closed last spring, 2011. Mm-hmm. So it's been empty since then. And I'm really interested in, you know, really using it as a way to show that these very intentionally planned mixed income, you know, things that produce economic diversity, could be the way to transform our communities, in particular poor communities around the country. And yes, we'd love to start that process in the South Bronx.
Mm-hmm. That's exciting.
It is exciting. Yeah.
Maybe really you get your little coffee cafe there.
Oh, that'd be lovely.
Right?
Yeah, I would hope so. That and you know, opportunities for small businesses to flourish, things like rapid prototyping. There's just a way to do small lot manufacturing, you know, using technology. Yes, I think there would be opportunities for technology-based urban agriculture, and I think there's even more opportunities to do really solid, you know, children's education that supports, you know, the growth and development of early childhood. You know, and then, of course, really high-quality housing of many different economic developments. So, you know, yes, we're interested in seeing, you know, affordable housing, you know, at different levels, but also we would really love to have the kind of housing that makes it so that people who actually would like to stay in their communities who've actually done well for themselves would actually want to live there because they actually have different opportunities there. So whether it is the cafes and the restaurants and the decent supermarkets and the places you to play and to just have fun at, those are the type of things that are woefully lacking in poor communities right now. So creating opportunities for those to exist and using a development like this to raise the bar for what passes as development, you know, in poor communities, I think is just going to be utterly transformative. Just the idea, I mean, that's like almost heretical, quite frankly, to think about doing that level of planning and that type of support in communities, in poor communities, because, you know, they should just be lucky with a little park and maybe an asthma clinic when the air is really dirty. You know, God forbid they ask for like real stuff and get it. And that's the kind of developer I want to be.
All right. Well, you touched on the supermarket issue, which is something that, you know, comes up a lot for me in the work that I'm doing. I always hear about food deserts, you know, and that in poor communities, you know, what I have come to believe is that there's very little access to good, healthy food in poor communities, which also keeps people unhealthy and makes it more difficult for children to learn in school. You know, and do you find that a reality in your area that I have heard you say that you don't believe that there's such a thing as a food desert? So, you know, and yet you see all these fast food places in poorer communities and very little access to really good markets.
One of my heroes is the director of agriculture and markets for the state, New York State Department of Agriculture, Bob Lewis, who I like to quote a lot, and he says, there is no such thing, you know, as a food desert, you know, especially in poor communities, because if there are such things as healthy food deserts. You know, you can always find food. I mean, there is not a lack of really horrible, horrible for you foods that you can mm-hmm. find pretty easily and incredibly cheaply, you know, in poor communities. Mm-hmm. You know, you can find, you know, the bodegas that will sell you these things. They call them quarter waters. You know, they're these little plastic things of water, you know, different colors, but, you know, not a healthy thing in it. You wouldn't be able to read the label of what's in this stuff. But they're a quarter, so people buy them and drink them a lot. You know, there's a lot of different, you know, both the commercial, you know, international, you know, fast food chains, the McDonald's and the rest of them. But there's also, like, a bunch of different small places that aren't selling, you know, healthy enough. They're not selling salads, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. So if you want healthy food, you know, don't come to a place like a poor community anywhere in New York City or in most communities around the country. You know, but if you want food that's not necessarily good for you, then you could always get something to eat, and you could get it for a lot cheaper than you can. I personally live in the South Bronx, and most of my food is actually, we import it from Manhattan, which means we get on the subway, we go down there with our little bags, and we bring our food up, because you can find fresh, healthy produce, believe it or not, in some of the wealthiest areas of Manhattan for a lot cheaper than you can find it in our communities.
Really? So healthy food in your communities are top dollar?
Yeah. And they're not the best quality. Mm-hmm. So I can go to, you know, a little fancy health food store and, you know, buy something, I can buy grapes, whatever, you know, for a lot cheaper generally than I can find it in my neighborhood. And mm-hmm. if I don't find it cheaper, then the quality is always better. And that's something that's important to me, you know, and I know this. So I go looking for it. But again, if you don't know that that's what's out there, then guess what? You're not going to do it. What I have been very encouraged by over the past few years is that there has been, you know, an interest in things like community-supported agriculture.
That's what I was just going to ask you.
So I'm a member of our, you know, CSA and in the community, which is called the Corbin Hill Community-Supported Agriculture, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful program. And so, you know, my husband and I buy the large share, and we're always psyched about it, you know, but it's a very tiny proportion of people in the community that are a part of it. And, you know, but it is about education, and it is about, you know, continuing to help people see the value of this. But, you know, it took us a long time to get to the point, you know, where people... You know, look, everybody in America was eating organic food, you know, just before and even right after the war. Everybody. Like, there was no such thing as non-organic food. I mean, it was later on, you know, people discovered chemical fertilizers and what they could do, and that's when it started to be put on our food, and that's when we started to eat it. So, you know, now it is much more cheaper, you know, sadly, thanks to
Monsanto
and food and the subsidies and the way that it's all done, you know.
I know, it's so funny that they called that the Green Revolution, poisoning our food system.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling. But mm-hmm. again, you know, it's been in our, you know, makeup for such a long time now, you know, that most people, you know, half our age don't know anything but this. So it is a bit of education that I think mm-hmm. we're pushing, you know, toward.
Yeah. Well, one thing with CSAs, and I don't know if you've seen any models that deal with this, but very often... What I have heard, many people cannot get into CSAs because you actually have to come up with the money up front.
Yeah.
And there are some models of CSAs in less affluent communities, I have heard, that are creating a situation where people can pay weekly.
Yeah, and this one does.
It
do
does.
That. I mean,
okay.
Look.
Because, you know, I can imagine for someone who's struggling to just make all their bills each week to come up with hundreds of dollars.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the season would be almost impossible for
many
people.
Right. I mean, we started years and years and years ago. We tried to start a CSA, and it was the hardest thing in the world to do because, you know, there wasn't an option to do that. And it just became clear that, you know what, I couldn't do it. We just couldn't do it. But, you know, there's been a lot of support, you know, to get healthy food in communities. And so folks like Corbin Hill have figured out a way to I don't know exactly how they do it, but they did it so that, you know, folks that are on the lower end of the economic spectrum that want to participate, you know, can do so in a way that doesn't hurt them.
Right.
And I think that's a really, you know, but they listened to people and followed up.
Right.
And that's what you have to do because, I mean, it would be hard, you know, for a lot of folks to do that. And they just recognize it and figured out how to deal with it.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah,
that's great. So what does the phrase "some of us are brave" mean to you?
Oh, I can't remember who said it, but the full quote is, I believe the men are black, the women are white, and some of us are brave. As in, the some of us are brave are the other ones who don't fit in those things. So as a black woman, you know, the default black person is a black man. The default woman is a white woman. And I'm a black woman, so where does that leave me? And, you know, quite frankly, it doesn't really matter where I'm left. The bottom line is I know that I've got work to do, and I'm going to do it anyway. And I think that's where that came from. And I hadn't heard that quote before, but when I did hear it, it literally kind of brought chills down my spine because...
Can you say the full quote again?
The men are black. Mm-hmm. The women are white, and some of us are brave.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, as a woman, do you feel like, in general, female leadership is undervalued?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Sadly, and you see it, unfortunately, you know, you see it in the number of board positions of women. You see it in the way that...
Because even as a white woman, I see it.
You see it in the way women are, you know, underrepresented in terms of funding and in community-based and other types of nonprofit organizations.
I see it in chefs, you know,
as a female chef, everywhere.
You know, it's like...
It's everywhere.
There's more female chefs than there are male chefs, but the ones that are really famous and that mm-hmm. are, you know, headlining the big events
right.
all seem to be the male.
Right, and in the chef. Philanthropic world, there's more women running nonprofit organizations, but we make a whole lot less money than... You know, our organizations make a whole lot less money than organizations run by men. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's an issue that we've got to... acknowledge and keep talking about and move forward on.
It's interesting, just like you said, you know, the civil rights movement, you know, after that it made it more difficult in some of the communities for people to have the aspirations of success. And I think a little bit true after the women's movement too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for a lot of women, all of a sudden now they had a add career on top of everything else. It's not like the men stepped up to the plate and started doing the child care
no.
and the house cleaning and all that stuff.
No.
Now all of a sudden women have to do the house cleaning, the child care,
right.
and have a career on
right.
top of it.
Right.
You know, and it's interesting. Sometimes I thought the whole women's lib thing like backfired on many of the women that are struggling with balancing it all. You know, because even when you end up getting divorced, it's like, you know, there was no longer alimony, you know,
right.
it's like you're left on your own.
Right. It's a tough thing. And, you know, and that's why we need everybody to be brave and acknowledge that there are issues out there and maybe get really uncomfortable when we're talking about this stuff. Because, you know, I think that if we're losing out, you know, on the voices, you know, of people, different kinds of people, then we all lose. We're not giving people an opportunity to actually add their best selves, you know, into a conversation and thus create the better change that's going to support everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all losing if we don't do that.
Right, right.
So.
Now, on numerous occasions, you've actually said that you have something in common with the Tea Party. Now,
mm-hmm.
I find that hard to believe. Can you please elaborate on that?
Sure. Like the Tea Party, I want a smaller government. I do. Except I believe you can create a smaller government by creating jobs for our most expensive citizens. And our most expensive citizens are people who are generationally impoverished, people who are coming back from our oil wars, our veterans, or people who are cycling in and out of the criminal justice system, people who disproportionately actually use a larger amount of our social service dollars, you know, taxpayer dollars for social services. So whether it's through unemployment or even, you know, public health issues or just sometimes domestic violence or even self-medicating, you know, through legal or illegal ways. I mean, I was just horrified when I found out that more veterans come back home and kill themselves than are killed in the war.
Mm, yeah. I never heard that.
Oh, yeah. It's quite, you know, the VA has put the stat out that, you know, there's more, there's been like a six-fold increase in pharmaceuticals, you know, for veterans, you know, coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan than there has been in almost a decade. So when you think about that, you know, who's paying for that? And these are America's most expensive citizens. But if you can create jobs, accessible jobs for them that actually provide both a benefit to the municipalities in which they work, in which they're doing these jobs, and also also provide therapeutic benefits for the people that are doing that work. And these particular jobs are in green infrastructure. So green infrastructure is a term that's you use a natural way to provide things like stormwater management, and air quality improvement, and also an energy conservation in our cities, you know, through things like green roof installation or urban forestry management, or even a wetland restoration as well. So these are things that naturally, you know, filter the air, you know, manage our stormwater, help, you know, create a more a lower ambient air temperature so that we're not cranking our air conditioners up as crazy and as high as we do. You know, green infrastructure can even, you know, or climate adaptation. There are ways to help us adapt to the changing climate. You know, so even when you think about all those, you know, what happened with the crazy weather that happened last week, you know, in the Southeast, you know, if by chance we'd buried those, you know, the utility lines, would all of those people have been without power for as long as they were? You know, that's climate adaptation. Those are the kind of things that can provide real benefits to the people that are working, you know, those jobs, and also the municipalities' benefits as well. And so it makes people go from taxpayers from tax burdens into being taxpayers. And, you know, people that work with greenery, actually there's an added therapeutic benefit to that that mm-hmm. actually helps reduce stress and creates all sorts of beneficial things for the people that are doing that work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, in my work also, I, you know, have one of the reasons I love food is I see the connection that mm-hmm. food has with economy and health yep. and environment, and the whole connection is just so obvious to
right.
me. And
yep.
to some people, they just don't see it all. And I, you know, in this recession and in this climate of, you know, people without work, what is what do you see that's going up all the time? New pharmacists,
mm-hmm.
you know, the new pharmacy on every corner.
I know.
A new bank on every
uh-huh,
corner.
Uh-huh.
And you think, what's going? You know,
our
what
tax
is going
dollars
on?
At work.
You know, and when you really start tracing back the dollars, you see that it's unfortunately, it feels like they're keeping us sick on purpose. Like it's good business.
You think so?
Yeah. You know, it's good business to keep us sick. It's like if we're all healthy, you know, pharmaceutical companies don't make money, the hospitals don't make money. It's like, but if we all were healthier, think of what less burden it would be
mm-hmm.
on the taxpayer and
yeah,
the dollar.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and
exactly
what you were talking about.
Exactly.
I mean, it's just, it's like such a duh thing.
Yeah. So
they don't get it.
I wish the Tea Party would like get on that because, yeah, I would stand up with them if they did and be like, yeah, like that's the kind of smaller government that we want. Because, you know, I don't feel great, you know, about spending social service dollars on folks and knowing full well that they're not it's not being used to help make people any better. I mean, it's not. So why don't we do things that are ultimately going to change the landscape of our communities, make them easier for people to live in, you know, make them happier, make them healthier, and provide jobs with real, tangible benefits? And the financial ones are great, you know, which gets them, you know, off of the social service rolls, but it also provides the kind of things that keeps them, you know, not so dependent, you know, on the social service dollars that ultimately aren't so great for them anyway.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you have any suggestions for any of the listeners out there, ways that they could get involved in any of your projects or, you know, one of the things I really like to promote because
yeah.
of the area I'm living in, too, is just people, everyone has to do something.
Right.
Everyone has to participate unpaid in helping make this world a better place, because it's just not going to happen if we all are waiting to get paid to do it.
Right. So in your own communities, I mean, just look around for things that need to be done, and don't be afraid to talk, you know, to others, to, because chances are they probably have the same issue that you do and just waiting for someone to get out there. And as for me, I mean, just keep, you know, us in mind. I mean, check our website every now and then.
MajoraCarterGroup.com.
Right. And we're starting a new organization, a local economic development nonprofit called Hometown Security Laboratories. And so we'll keep that in mind, too.
Great. I'll share that on my newsletter with everybody.
Thank you. Cool.
Everyone out there, thank you so much for spending this past hour with us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and my guest has been Majora Carter from the Majora Carter Group. Have a great day, everybody, and I'll see you next week.